Are you looking for a summer read that immerses you in the beauty of the natural world? Well, maybe recommend Helen MacDonald's essay collection, Vesper Flights, just out in paperback. I look at a field, I see and I love that field. Helen sees below the field, the nesting and burrowing inhabitants. You might have read her essays in the New York Times or her beautiful 2014 memoir, H is for Hawk, about how she dealt with grief over the death of her father by training a goshawk. It turns out, though, while I see her completely connected to the natural world, Helen MacDonald still sees a divide, and it's an appropriate one. And she sees those fields and meadows where none of us would, say, at the top of the Empire State Building. Again, Helen MacDonald's book is Vesper Flights. We spoke when it was first published. Welcome back.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
This book is lovely. It's filled with short essays, but together they form a memoir. And it turns out the thing that I admired in you, this like intense connection with the natural world, we find out was a problem when you were a child. You'd wander away from like a team sport when you were a kid to hear a bird call, and that upset kids. And you were bullied.
Yeah, I was bullied. I was a strange child, you know. I don't think I fitted in at all. I was a very serious child, and I loved animals. And yeah, I was on a school sports day court, and I wandered off because I heard this bird song, and everyone was like, you know, what are you doing? You were in goal. So I think I just didn't really understand people back then. And, you know, one of the great things that's happened, you know, growing up was I've learned to love people as well as animals. So I feel that's a triumph.
You also say in your very last essay that while you love those animals so much, you've come to realize they don't exist for us.
Yeah, I think it's one of the big, I guess, themes of this book. You know, we're living in a world, as all your listeners know, in which empathy seems to be in shorter and shorter supply. And when we look at animals, what we're seeing when we see them is it's very hard to see the real creature. What we're seeing is all the meaning we put on them, all the thing we've learned from books and magazine articles and things we've heard about them and photographs. And I think it's important to think about what we bring to that moment of contact with a creature. If you're very lucky, you can think about what you've brought to that encounter, but then you can look past it and you can see the real animal, this strange non-human alien creature that possesses the world just as we possess the world. And you know, it's a real lesson about the fact that the world doesn't belong to us. It's a kind of radical empathy, and I think it's really important now.
They don't exist to teach us, even if they do. They have their own thing
exactly.
going on. You mentioned growing up, and your childhood home was in a home that your parents bought on this 50-acre estate that was owned by the Theosophical Society. Your parents weren't theosophists, but your neighbors were. These are refugees from Nazi Germany. How did that impact you?
It was a grand crowd of mostly older ladies, and they were very eccentric, and they just lived their lives according to their own, you know, what they thought was right. They were not sticklers to convention at all. And they were a real inspiration to me, I think. You know, I was a strange child. I'm possibly a strange person. But I've never felt I needed to fit in with the stories that society tells you about what you're supposed to do. And I think those ladies, I bless them for that. And they had wonderful names. There was sort of Kate Batty Smith, who had a great orc egg in a drawer. And another person had a whole bunch of jewelry that Howard Carter had given her from his excavations in Egypt. I mean, they were really a grand old crew.
Well, this is interesting. Yes, it does sound like you fit right in. But you start the book in the introduction by describing a Wunderkammer. A cabinet of wonders?
Yes.
And I'm imagining that's something you learned there. And these are cabinets people would put things into touch and, you know, kind of marvel over them, preserve specimens, feathers. By the way, the book has been described as a Wunderkammer, too, you know, a collection of just wonders.
Yeah. It's a metaphor I came up with because, you know, I think we see the natural world so often these days as something that's behind, almost like it's behind plate glass. We're not supposed to touch it or interact with it. And it reminds me of how we walk around museums. All the exhibits are in cases and, you know, they're all kind of arranged according to particular categories and we stare at them seriously and we, you know, we muse on their meaning. But these Wunderkammer, these 16th century cases of curiosities, the whole point of them was that you could reach out and pick things up and examine them and glory in their weight and the differences from each other. And they weren't arranged like museum specimens. There were all sorts of things all pushed together, like shells and cloaks and weapons and paintings. And I wanted my book to be a little bit like that, to have all these different things that were wondrous, hopefully, all pushed into the same place, and readers felt that they could kind of reach in and kind of be part of that story.
Talk about the Empire State Building. You hooked up with someone from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, who also is a part of a movement to document bird migration through radar and all these modern technologies. Twice a year, if you climb to the top of the Empire State Building, which shoots a light up, which is how you see these birds, and you bring your binoculars, what did you see?
It was the most sublime experience. It shook me, and it completely changed the way I think not only about New York City, a place that I really love, but also about the air. You know, I assumed that the air was this place that was pretty much empty. And, you know, it was dynamic, but there was nothing there. I climbed up the Empire State Building and met Andrew Farnsworth, and it was a big migration night. All these tiny birds were being pulled north by their instinct, in May. And there were hundreds of thousands of birds going across New York. And they were so high that you can't see them from the ground. But, you know, we're high up enough to see them. And I was watching them through binoculars and, you know, through, with the naked eye as well. And these tiny little frames, these tiny songbirds that were illuminated from beneath by the lights of the building. And there were so many of them, they looked almost like tracer fire or sort of stars passing overhead. Mm. And they're so frail. And it was really emotional to sort of think of how that building operated a little bit like a deep sea submersible, only rather than taking me down to the depths of the ocean to see the creatures there, it was lifting me up into the sky. It was marvelous.
But you remind us, too, how dangerous the city can be for birds as they hit windows and buildings. And Andrew Farnsworth is part of a group. I remember when this happened. There's the tribute to the lives lost on September 11th. Lights are shot 4 miles into the air. And on peak migration nights, the songbirds are brought down to the lights. And so they flick around in them. You write like glittering, whirling specks of paper. And he, along with members of the Audubon Society, get them to turn the lights off several times so that they won't pull the birds in.
Yeah, it's a really poignant thought, these tiny souls being brought in and trapped in these columns that are there to commemorate, you know, the terrible loss of life on that day. And so he steps in and he turns them off every so often so the birds are freed from these columns of light and they can continue their journey. It's you know, really a strong kind of image to conjure with.
You describe seeing night herons flying over you when you're up on the Empire State Building. I will never look at the night sky the same way again after reading that. But staying with birds, swifts are especially compelling to you. You say they're the closest things to aliens on Earth. Why?
Well, they're a bit like angels, too. I'm all over swifts. They're just magical. So they're incredibly aerial birds. They very rarely land. European swifts, once the youngsters leave the nest, they don't touch down at all for maybe 2 or 3 years. They live in the air as a fish would live in the ocean. And because they're so inaccessible to, you know, you can't really see them up close, I was always astounded by them. And I have an essay about this phenomenon called a Vespa flight. And it's something that science has discovered quite recently. And one of the things I try and do in this book, you know, we so often think that science subtracts beauty from the world, but actually, I think it just shows us more and more how astonishing everything is. So what these swifts do, they've discovered, is every morning and every evening, the birds will climb up higher and higher into the sky, and they'll reach these impossible heights, thousands and thousands of feet up. And they reach the apex of these flights at nautical twilight. And it turns out that one of the reasons they might be doing this is to find out exactly where they are. So they use the stars, they use polarization patterns in the sky. They can look out across the horizon and they can see oncoming weather systems and they can feel the wind from those clouds coming towards them. And then they decide what they're going to do next, where they're going to go. And they do that communally. And this image of swifts communally deciding where they are and what they're going to do next is a really important theme for me, in the sense that it seems that they're a kind of fable of community now. We are all, you know, with the pandemic, with what's happening, it's a year where we haven't been looking out to see our futures. And I don't know, the swifts just seem like a really important symbol for me about how we can do that better.
And Vesper Flights is the title of the essay Helen MacDonald's written on swifts. It's also the title of her new collection of essays, Vesper Flights, You Will Take Wing. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Our conversation from last September, Vesper Flights, is out in paperback.